It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
Hey now, hope you had a good Mother's Day weekend. There has been a lot of media coverage of my interview at the White House with Jen Psaki, which aired on Media Buzz yesterday. You can see that interview on our webpage, on Facebook, Twitter, easy to find. And what was fascinating to me is I looked at 5 different news accounts, and they led with 5 different things because it was such a wide-ranging interview. One talked about her feelings about leaving the job of press secretary. Her last day is Friday. Another, how she felt about being made fun of at the White House Correspondents' Dinner by Trevor Noah. Another one had to do with when I asked her about the increasing attacks on Donald Trump and how she handled that. But I thought the most newsworthy thing, and another account in the Daily Mail actually picked this up, is I pressed Jen Psaki 3 times on how she could say it wasn't a partisan issue, Roe v. Wade, because you have a very passionate minority in the country, according to polls, that believes that abortion is wrong, that believe abortion is murder, that believes that is actually celebrating the draft leaked opinion by Justice Samuel Alito. And each time she kept coming back to, well, 2/3 of the public approves, and 2/3 of the public approves. And I thought she might say, well, we respect the views of anybody on this important and sensitive issue, however, majority support. But she chose not to do that. Same thing had to do with this whole question of her attacking the media focus on the leaks. Who at the Supreme Court, right or left, decided it was a good idea to give a physical copy or photocopy of this draft opinion to Politico? And I think it was kind of a layup for the White House just to say, well, you know, we deplore any leaks that undermines the court's credibility. However, we think this is a distraction and so forth. And again, the White House has chosen not to do that. In the interview, Psaki told me that she believes that Republicans don't want to talk about the impact on a woman's right to choose as she sees it. And again, I kept trying to steer her back. And, you know, there's a lot of back and forth there. There's some lighter moments as well. So if you didn't get a chance to see it, I recommend it to you. I was on Fox and Friends a couple hours before my show yesterday, and I was asked a question about the new press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, former MSNBC analyst, Psaki, of course, heading to MSNBC. And we talked about the criticism of a conflict, even though she won't say exactly where she's going, in that interview as well. I had a chance to meet Karine. Everybody who works with her or knows her tells me she's just a smart and lovely and terrific person. I have no reason to doubt that. It was Jen Psaki herself, and this ended up delaying our interview, who introduced her at the in the briefing room as the first Black presidential press secretary and the first openly gay presidential press secretary. But I was asked a question about the following fact. Karine Jean-Pierre's partner is CNN correspondent Suzanne Malveaux. And they've been completely and totally open about this. They live together. They have a 7-year-old daughter. They praise each other. It's in a book. And so, nevertheless, there's obviously a conflict of interest question because, a reporter for CNN, and by the way, I know Suzanne Malveaux. She's had a terrific career at the network. She's been an anchor. She's been a foreign correspondent. She's traveled around the world. She's covered the White House. But now her partner is going to be the White House press secretary. And I said, this obviously raises a question, and Suzanne Malveaux cannot continue to cover anything that is remotely involved with President Biden or the White House. I think that's just a recognition of reality. This has happened with other people. It comes up more in Democratic administrations, but sometimes it comes up in Republican administrations. The New York Post quoting sources saying that CNN is not going to allow her to do that. But, you know, in the past few months, I just did a quick search. While Karine Jean-Pierre was deputy press secretary, Suzanne Malveaux did one story, civil rights leaders call for Biden to put full weight behind voting rights. She did one, Democrats hope to make progress on Build Back Better in new year. I just think with the heightened scrutiny, that's not going to fly. And again, there were a lot of two career couples in Washington, and this is not an unusual situation, but now that her partner is the White House press secretary, obviously that does change the situation. Quick note about Donald Trump. Mark Esper, who was fired by Donald Trump as defense secretary, has a book out with a lot of stunning revelations in it, and you would think we'd be beyond the point of stunning revelations. I'll get into that tomorrow because I want to give it a lot of time, and I've got a lot of things to get to. But just because there's a sort of a playbook here, I thought I would share with you that Trump said it was a complete lie, Esper's claim that he wanted to shoot protesters in the legs. This was outside the White House in the wake of the George Floyd killing, and had described cabinet members as effing losers. Mark Esper was weak and totally ineffective, and because of it, says the former president, I had to run the military. This was a statement given to 60 Minutes because Esper was on 60 last night. I took out ISIS, Soleimani, al-Baghdadi, rebuilt the military with $2.5 trillion, created Space Force, and so much more. Mark Esper was a stiff who was desperate not to lose his job. He was a lightweight and a figurehead, and I realized it very early on. So add to the list of former officials who Trump praised when he was appointing and now is very upset with. All right, let's get to story number one, the continuing fallout over the draft opinion and possible final opinion, we shall see, by the Supreme Court of the United States, which is at least considering invalidating Roe v. Wade. So Mitch McConnell, in an interview with USA Today that was published over the weekend, said it was possible that if that is the final ruling and Republicans take control of Congress, that they will look to pass a nationwide ban on abortion. Now, keep in mind, under the Alito draft, at least, abortion would be returned to the states. And we know that about half the states would immediately, there are trigger laws, would immediately outlaw abortion, make it illegal. In another half of the states, you know, roughly speaking, abortion will remain legal, and many people, obviously, many women who want abortions, would travel to the states where it's legal. So I had been saying that even though the Democrats are trying to make this the number one issue in the country, rather than what Republicans want to talk about, the economy, inflation, and so forth, that it will be an issue in governor's races and state rep races, but at the same time, members of Congress don't have anything to say about it. There's going to be a vote on codifying Roe this week, and Chuck Schumer doesn't have the votes in the Senate. But for McConnell to say this, I don't understand why he would say this, because now he's opened the door for Democrats to say you should vote Democratic in the House and Senate races, because this is what the Republicans want to do. McConnell just said it was possible, but he didn't rule it out. I don't know why. I mean, he could do whatever he wants if he becomes majority leader again. I don't know why he would sort of hand the other party that issue. And indeed, New York Times is reporting that congressional leaders and around the country of Republican persuasion have suddenly grown quiet on the issue, part of a bid to avoid a backlash against their party. They're certainly not doing a victory lap. Donald Trump is not doing a victory lap, as I mentioned last week on the podcast. Republicans appear determined to recast their position as one of moderation and avert the gaze of voters away from their anti-abortion rights agenda. In fact, there was a memo from the National Republican Senatorial Committee obtained by Axios that said abortion should be avoided as much as possible. States should have the flexibility to implement reasonable restrictions. So this is what the key political body for the Republicans in the Senate is telling candidates and incumbents, like, don't talk about this, avoid it. So it's not the imagination. I mean, the problem for the GOP is there are a lot, they're not necessarily Democrats. I talked about this with Jen Psaki. There are plenty of independent suburban voters, women, who don't want Roe tossed out, whether they are thinking that they might want the option of abortion in the future, or their kids might, or whatever. So that's the state of play there. There's also an interesting analysis in the Times by Peter Baker talking about the red America and the blue America and how this will further would make the chasm even wider. There's really no question about it. I mean, out in California, Governor Gavin Newsom is talking about amending the state's constitution to protect abortion rights, while in Oklahoma, Governor Kevin Stitt, a Republican, just signed new legislation prohibiting abortion after 6 weeks. You know, that was the draconian position in Texas, which now looks less draconian because it's not a complete ban. And what Baker writes in this story is that, you know, whether it's critical race theory or the Electoral College, we have, you know, we really do have sort of two Americas, the populous Northeast, Mid-Atlantic Seaboard and West Coast on the left, and the South, most of the Mountain West on the right, and the Midwest kind of split. Interesting historical note, 5 of the last 6 presidents talked about healing this divide. George H.W. Bush called for a kinder and gentler nation. Bill Clinton promised to be the repairer of the breach. George W. Bush called himself a uniter, not a divider. Barack Obama declared that it was not a blue America and a red America, but the United States of America. And every one of them failed. The piece says that Trump didn't really do much to advance the cause of unity. He spent his presidency playing to his base. Now, I want to get into the demonstrations because I'm pretty hepped up about this. And I'll just start by letting Rich Lowry talk about this in National Review. Over the weekend, protesters showed up at the Home of Justices. This was in suburban Maryland. John Roberts, which makes no sense because John Roberts doesn't want to overturn Roe v. Wade. The Chief Justice is looking to throw out or to uphold, I should say, this Mississippi restrictive abortion law, but not to invalidate Roe. And Brett Kavanaugh, who is part of that, at least tentatively, five-person, five-justice majority that would invalidate Roe. Now, here's Lowry. This is a shameful further step down for our political culture, which wasn't particularly elevated to begin with. It's a deeply illiberal act that adds an element of menace to the deliberations of a body that's supposed to be above the fray and not subject to political threats. It's up to people of goodwill to condemn these demonstrations, yet the White House pointedly refused to discourage them in a shocking betrayal, says Lowry, of its duty to good order and lawfulness. These weren't run-of-the-mill protests. No one doubts that demonstrations have an important role in showing popular support for or passion around a given cause. No, these protests were and were meant to be threatening. There's no reason to go to the homes of the justices unless it is to send the message, we know where you live. Beware. And I agree with all that. Imagine how the coverage would be if conservative demonstrators were upset about a conservative law being thrown out by the Supreme Court, went to Sonia Sotomayor's house, Elena Kagan's house, Nancy Pelosi's house. Wouldn't we see a lot of anguish pieces about this is wrong and this shouldn't be encouraged and this is intimidation? It's just stunning. And, you know, I'm all for peaceful protest. Absolutely. March outside the Supreme Court. Protest at the White House. These are public buildings. It's part of a long tradition. It's in America's DNA. Protest all you want as long as it's peaceful. And yet, go into the homes. And yet, the Washington Post showing no concern whatsoever for the fear factor. You know, imagine you're holed up inside your house while people late at night are shouting slogans and marching and you're there with your kids. Rather than condemn that, the Washington Post has a long, sympathetic profile about the woman who is leading the protest outside Brett Kavanaugh's house. That is just tone deaf in my view, and it just seems really politically biased. Meanwhile, in Madison, Wisconsin, police are investigating a fire that was set at a group opposed to abortion, the Wisconsin Family Action. Obviously, a Molotov cocktail was thrown in there. I saw some pictures. It did some damage. Somebody spray painted, just in case there was any doubt where this came from, somebody spray painted the outside of the building saying, if abortions aren't safe, then you aren't either. This is lawlessness. This is intimidation. And it reminds me during the Vietnam War, I mean, the huge demonstrations against the Vietnam War, if you were against that war, it certainly played a role in affecting public opinion. But then there were those who engaged in violence, those on the left who thought that, you know, killing people and setting off bombs was a good idea. And it discredited part of the movement. And we're seeing that now. I hope this is just an isolated instance. Meanwhile, Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves, a Republican on CNN yesterday, would not rule out his state banning certain kinds of contraception, such as Plan B or IUDs. He said, oh, we're not focused on it at this time, thereby lending credence to the Democratic argument that they're not going to stop with abortion. It's going to go to same-sex marriage, contraception, and other things.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
All right, let me move on to the war. Story number two. Jill Biden showed up yesterday, the first lady, visiting Ukraine, an unannounced visit that became public in the morning hour time. She met with Ukraine's first lady, Zelensky's wife. And I thought it was a tremendous thing to do. I thought she handled herself extremely well. She's very poised in these situations. Griff Jenkins on my show said he thinks that this increases the pressure on Joe Biden to go. But regardless, at least a member of the Biden family showed up. What also happened today in Russia was this was the big anniversary of Russia declaring victory over Nazi Germany in World War II, a very emotional day in Russia that's always celebrated with a big military parade. And there'd been so much punditry about Vladimir Putin. Was he going to escalate the war? What was he going to do? And it turns out he didn't really do anything. I mean, he gave a speech. He didn't announce plans to escalate the war. He didn't announce that he considered that he has victory in Ukraine and try to find a face-saving way off. You know, he praised the troops. And he, again, tried to use the victory over the Nazis in World War II, which, of course, was then allied, the Soviet Union then allied with the United States, Britain, and the West, to argue that they're fighting Nazis in Ukraine, which is just the big lie. He had described Ukrainians as Nazi filth. This is completely and totally bogus, but he didn't take any of those steps. Now, by the way, I have a video up, my After the Buzz video, talking about, and I said this on the podcast last week, what an awful decision it was, first for U.S. officials to be leaking this stuff about how American intelligence helped the Ukrainians kill Russian generals and sink that Russian battleship. And I don't think that either of these should have been published. So here's Tom Friedman, multiple Pulitzer Prize winning columnist in the New York Times. I hadn't seen this until after I made that video. As a journalist, I love a good leak story, and the reporters who broke that story did powerful digging. Everything I've been able to glean, however, says Friedman, is that President Biden was livid about these leaks. I'm told he called the Director of National Intelligence, the CIA Director, and the Defense Secretary to make clear in the strongest and most colorful language that this kind of loose talk is reckless and has got to stop immediately before we end up in an unintended war with Russia. Couldn't agree more. But, you know, Friedman only looks at one part of the equation. He's not going to criticize his newspaper for publishing this. He says, oh, it's all the fault of the people who leaked. Okay, it is the fault of the people who leak. Without those unnamed U.S. sources, these stories could not be reported. But don't the New York Times and NBC, as well as the Washington Post, which also confirmed the battleship sinking story, don't they have some journalistic responsibility too? Couldn't they have declined to publish this? That's the position that I take. All right, number three, your daily Elon episode is not a laughing matter today. Looking at a piece in London Sun, Elon Musk went on Twitter and said, if I die under mysterious circumstances, it's been nice knowing you. Okay, what's that about? Is it just Elon being Elon? No. It turns out, here's another post by Musk, the word Nazi doesn't mean what he seems to think it does, and that he refers to a translation from a Russian media outlet. And here's what it says. This is what caused Musk to talk about what I guess he perceived as a potential death threat. From the testimony of the captured commander of the 36th Marine Brigade of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, turns out that The internet terminals of Elon Musk's Starlink satellite company were delivered to the militants of the Nazi Azov battalion and the Ukrainian Marines in Mariupol by military helicopters. This is the translation Musk is posting. According to our information, this was carried out by the Pentagon. Elon Musk thus is involved in supplying the fascist forces in Ukraine with military communications equipment. And for this, Elon, you will be held accountable like an adult, no matter how much you play the fool. Now, it is true that Musk has donated to the Ukrainians this sort of mobile satellite technology to help them with communications, because a lot of their stuff has been shut down by Kremlin cyber attacks. And he attached a warning saying, Starlink is the only non-Russian communication system still working in some parts of Ukraine, so probability of being targeted is high. So this is pretty chilling. I don't know if the thing that he's quoting is just one guy's opinion or there is a threat there, but I think it was smart of him to make it public. Story number four. I have a personal stake in this one. Huge front page story in yesterday's New York Times about Ed Koch, the late New York mayor who served for three terms. And I knew Ed Koch when I was based in New York. I interviewed Ed Koch numerous times. I later interviewed him on television. He was a larger-than-life force as the mayor of New York City. And in this deep dive, and I have to say it's extremely well reported and very sensitively done, the Times says that by the time he was retired and in his 70s, Koch described to a few friends a feeling he could not shape, a deep loneliness. He wanted to meet someone, that he didn't know anybody who might be partner material. He told Charles Kaiser, one friend, "I want a boyfriend." It was an aching admission, shared with only a few, from a politician whose relentless New York evangelism helped define the modern mayoralty. He always concealed this essential fact. Mr. Koch was gay. He denied as much for decades to reporters, campaign operatives, and his staff. And what's interesting about the piece, and I'll get into my take on it, is that the people who are coming out here, they're almost all on the record. They're describing the anguish that he went through as a closeted gay man for 40 years in public life and in his retirement. Most are gay men themselves, in whom Koch placed his trust while keeping others closest to him in the dark. They include associates who had kept his confidence since the 1970s, late-in-life intimates who he asked for dating help, a friend who assisted in furtive setups for Koch when he was mayor, and a fleeting romantic companion from well after his time in office. It also discloses the identity of a guy by the name of Dick Nathan, who he did have a relationship with when he was a congressman, but once he became mayor, he not only refused to give this guy an appointment, he basically told him to leave town. And Richard Nathan, Harvard-educated healthcare consultant, moved to California and was very hurt by this and ultimately died of AIDS. Koch stunned senior staff members assembled in a city hall office one day with a sudden declaration, "I am not a homosexual." Talks about his political consultant, the legendary David Garth, who needed to be assured before he took on the 1977 campaign, when Koch won his first mayor's race, that the rumors about the bachelor congressman being gay were not true. He went into the office of a gay Koch friend and said, "Is he a," and it's an F word that was a common slur for gays at that time. "If that son of a bitch lied to me and he's an F blank, I would never have taken him on." Now, here's my, and it also talks about whether or not Koch needed to be more cautious during the AIDS crisis of the 1980s because he didn't want to be too closely associated with this. Now, here is the one thing I have to say about this. Everybody in New York knew that Ed Koch was gay. This was the biggest open secret of all time. If you were over the age of 12, you knew that Ed Koch was gay. It was whispered about, it was talked about, despite all the denials to the press, to his staff, to his inner circle, to people in agencies. Everybody knew it. I mean, when he campaigned for mayor in 77, he had by his side constantly Bess Meyerson, who I later covered when she got involved in a judge-fixing divorce case the sensation of New York City at the time. She was there to imply that she was Koch's girlfriend. Everybody knew what was going on, that was fakery. When Koch ran against Mario Cuomo in one race, and Cuomo always denied any responsibility for this whisker campaign, the slogan was, "Vote for Cuomo, not the homo." Forgive me for saying that, but that was widely reported. It's in this Times piece. So I just think it's an important story to be done. One of the takeaways here is a lot of his gay friends urged him to come out, as mayor, particularly when he was retired. And it is a reminder that it was not that long ago that it would have been considered political suicide to acknowledge, even in liberal New York City, that you were gay. Now, of course, if Koch had lived longer, maybe he would have done it. Obviously today, although, 10 years ago, remember, it was only 10 years ago that Barack Obama came out for same-sex marriage. It was only 10 or 9 years ago that certain anchors everybody kind of knew were gay, came out publicly and embraced it. So attitudes changed slowly over time. So again, if you're interested in Ed Koch or New York City politics, and by the way, Ed Koch could be a really mean guy. And I was once interviewing him on television and asked him a question he didn't like, and he started questioning my sex life. And it was a despicable thing to do. I mean, he was very charming in certain ways. He was also a very tough character in certain ways. Anyway, the Times has this revelation that, again, I have to say, is not really a revelation to most of the people, at least who were living in New York City then. I mean, obviously, a lot of time has passed since Ed Koch was mayor, served 3 terms. I covered his last campaign, the one he lost in the primary to David Dinkins. Not because of this, but certainly the Times piece says he was pretty exhausted by that time, and this may have been a factor.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
All right, story number 5. This just stunned me. And it shows you, listen to this. It's called a newspaper. I've got the Washington Post here as a book review. And I never would have seen this online, but I discovered it because, I take the papers home. A book review call of a book called The Newspaper Access. This has to do with Hitler and the run-up to World War II. And I didn't know any of this, and this is stunning. About certain newspaper owners who became allied with Hitler. So let's start in London, where the owner of the London Daily Mail, Lord Harold Rothmere, a right-wing tabloid at the time, some people would say maybe still, he gushed in print about Hitler had saved his country and had brought immense benefits to Germany. Rothmere was even more fawning in private letters addressed to my dear Führer. Okay, let's go to the U.S. There were 3 relatives that led the charge here in favor of Hitler. Joseph Medill Patterson, who ran the New York Daily News, which was the highest circulation paper in the country at that time. His sister, Sissy Patterson, who was in charge of the Washington Times Herald, which at the time was the best-selling paper in D.C., not the Washington Post, and their cousin, Robert McCormick, who published the Chicago Tribune. And in this group also, William Randolph Hearst, who had this huge media empire of newsreels, magazines, wire service, and lots of major newspapers. So Hearst went the furthest, according to this book review. He allowed Hitler and Mussolini to write self-serving propaganda for his newspapers in the 1930s and paid them handsomely for it. After meeting with Hitler in Berlin in 1934, Hearst was enthusiastic about the way Hitler had restored character and courage to Germany, and this is really pathetic. On that same trip, a film swapping deal was struck between Hearst and Hitler, in which part of the Hearst Company's newsreels would be shown in Germany, and in exchange, Hearst would place German newsreel footage, unfiltered Nazi propaganda, in the films shown to American audiences. So he not only became a conveyor belt for blatant, raw Nazi propaganda showed to American moviegoers, but he made money off the deal. It's just unbelievable. Now, it is true that it says McCormick and Patterson didn't have any great affinity for Hitler, but they fiercely opposed any aid to Britain that might risk drawing the United States into war. Well, that's a legitimate position in retrospect, and the broad sweep of history is a totally wrong position. But remember, Franklin Delano Roosevelt didn't ask the U.S. to go to war until after Pearl Harbor was attacked in 1941. He was moving the U.S. in that direction, but public opinion wasn't there. So it's legitimate for a newspaper to argue, and of course it got into the news coverage, not just the editorials, that the U.S. shouldn't join the war. It was the isolationist movement at the time. But even after Pearl Harbor, even after the U.S. was fighting Nazi Germany, not to mention Japan, Hearst, McCormick, the Pattersons, continued to describe the number one enemy of America as FDR and his administration, the most insidious enemies. That tells you something about, it's a shameful chapter. And talk about being on the wrong side of history. That's a very, very valuable book, and I'm glad to have that information. Obviously, there are echoes today having to do with Russia and Ukraine. Once again, hope you enjoyed your weekend. I would be very grateful if you would subscribe, if you're not already a subscriber to this podcast. Apple iTunes is one place you can do it. Google Podcasts, Spotify, or you can get it on your Amazon device. We'll see you back here tomorrow with more Buzz Meter.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.